Welcome to the Public Morality. One of the expectations that we seemingly embrace, especially in presidential politics, is the hope that whoever is elected will somehow bring the nation together. The genuine desire to have the nation in some respects unified seems to forego any responsibility on the citizen, in other words, civic virtue. A concept rooted in the formation of the American Republic, civic virtue seems all but lost in the 21st century. What is it? Why is it important? And can the nation survive without it? Joining me to address these questions and others is Professor Kevin Marinelli. Professor Marinelli is Executive Director of the Program for Public Discourse at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Professor Kevin Marinelli, welcome to the Public Morality.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's begin by having you define what is civic virtue for you?
Well, I think it's important first to define virtue in general.
Okay.
And I draw on Aristotle's concept of virtue because I think it's a useful one. And he was one of the first philosophers to theorize really in depth about virtue ethics. And for Aristotle, recognizing and fulfilling your purpose is synonymous with virtue, and it's necessary to living a good life, a happy life. So in that way, virtue has intrinsic value. Everything and everyone has an intrinsic purpose, and virtue then is excellence with regard to that purpose. So that, of course, begs the question, what is the purpose of human beings? And for Aristotle, human beings are defined by their capacity for reason. So then for Aristotle, to be virtuous is to engage in sound reasoning. Now, interestingly, this connects us to the concept of civic virtue, because Aristotle doesn't end at reason. He says reason is what allows us to do politics. And politics is the highest art of all for Aristotle, because it's in politics that we achieve the greater good for the entire community. But interestingly, it doesn't just begin with reason either. Aristotle, in fact, says that it's speech that allows us to engage in reason. And many philosophers following Aristotle will actually dismiss speech and language as something derivative or even opposing reason. But for Aristotle, speech is central to it. So we have this beautiful progression of thought here. Speech allows for the capacity for reason. Reason allows for politics, and politics allows for the common good. So to return to your initial question, what is civic virtue for me? It's more than just a commitment to the common good. For me, it's a commitment to cultivating the means by which we can achieve the common good, central to which is speech. So for me, civic virtue is about attending to speech practices, listening to others, engaging in thoughtful speech, considering alternative perspectives, and thinking about the process, the democratic process itself, in and of itself, rather than using democracy merely as a means to an end. And that's what we do at the Program for Public Discourse, is specifically try to cultivate those means of democratic action through public discourse.
And because America is specifically in a democratic republic, can any kind of democratic form of government survive without some appreciation for civic virtue?
I think it would be a big challenge, and it would be devoid of what makes democracy great if you don't have a concept of civic virtue.
Part of the problem, Professor Marinelli, is that when was the last time, outside of academia and outside of you appearing on the Public Morality, was the importance of civic virtue discussed in our public discourse?
Well, I think civic virtue is a reoccurring theme in politics, even if politicians don't use that term, perhaps because they worry it might appear heavy-handed. You know, the term civic virtue or virtue in general smacks of religious doctrine, even though in reality it has a much broader definition, which we just discussed. In fact, from what I understand, the Program for Public Discourse was initially termed or titled the Program for Civic Virtue, but the name was later switched. And I wasn't part of that conversation, but I guess it would have something to do with that concern of that heavy-handedness. But in any case, when John F. Kennedy, for example, implores citizens, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, he's evoking a sense of civic virtue. So I do think it's a reoccurring theme in politics, whether or not we use that explicit term. And I'm really not particularly invested in whether people use the term or not. What is particularly interesting here is that, you know, this of course becomes a famous line in a famous speech, so it was a successful rhetorical appeal, which tells me that there is this imminent sense of civic virtue in citizens, that whether or not they realize it. So it's really just a question of how well we do targeting and cultivating that sense of civic virtue that I always think is present to some extent.
And these are my words, but it seems to some degree that we're handcuffed by what I would define as a zero-sum game, in that our politics such that it is that it's not enough for me to win. You, Professor Marinelli, must also, as the opposition, must also lose. And if that's how I'm thinking, doesn't that put me at odds of any kind of notion of civic virtue that you just articulated?
Yeah, politics can't be a zero-sum game. It has to include compromise. And I think with a real sense of civic virtue, you're willing to compromise. There's a concept of democracy called agonistic democracy that acknowledges the competitive spirit of politics while also emphasizing the central importance of the democratic process itself. So if the system collapses in the process of achieving your ends, then you've actually failed. And by collapsing the system, I don't just mean a formal collapse such as a political coup, but also people's loss of trust in the system itself. People have to believe that even if the election doesn't go their way, the system will still work in their general interest. Without that fundamental trust, democracy cannot function. So it really comes back to trust. Virtue is another word for trustworthiness.
You know, we often hear, especially during presidential elections, a desire for a candidate, whoever wins, the people want someone who will unite the nation. And I take that as an authentic appeal, but at the same time, I guess I wonder, doesn't that minimize, let's say, my responsibility as an individual and the importance that I place on civic virtue as you defined it earlier through the Aristotle perspective?
How so?
Well, let's just take, since President-elect Biden won, let's just take President-elect Biden. I support President-elect Biden because I believe he can bring the nation together. Doesn't that sort of minimize, am I not minimizing my own responsibility in that civic virtue piece to bring the nation together by just putting it on one individual?
Yes, I see what you're saying. Absolutely. Yeah, we can't defer it to others. You know, in many ways, the political process, and particularly party politics, is a reductive practice. You know, we reduce very complex issues to political parties, and then we reduce those parties to political leaders. And it's very reductive. And you're absolutely right. When we reduce these complexities to these symbols, then we're not engaging in that process of virtue, the process itself that cultivates the virtue, the investing ourselves in these difficult challenges. So you're absolutely right. It shouldn't let us off the hook. We have to continue to struggle with these perennial challenges in our daily lives.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Professor Kevin Marinelli. Professor Marinelli is the Executive Director of the Program for Public Discourse at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And we are discussing the topic of civic virtue. Professor Marinelli, when you consider what the founders had in mind and where we are today, what comes to your mind? Are we close to what they had in mind? Are we miles apart? It doesn't matter. Tell me, what comes to your mind?
Well, it's a great question. It's a very difficult question because in many ways we live in a vastly different world from our founding fathers. It's easy to say that in many respects we fall short of their ideals. In other respects, we've certainly surpassed them regarding their own, you know, limitations and shortcomings. So it's a complex question because it's really a mixed bag. I don't look at history as a linear trajectory. I don't know how idealist our founding fathers were. They certainly created mechanisms, some of which we utilize today, that, you know, that have really stood the test of time. But, you know, many of them have also been adapted to fit our changing landscape as well.
Well, on that last note, you often hear one side of the political aisle, you know, always hearkening back to what the founders intended. But you just articulated it's quite possible that the world that we live today is not the world that the founders could comprehend, maybe with the exception of Alexander Hamilton and the economic system, that aside. So this whole notion of civic virtues, as I'm hearing you articulate it, can be, and maybe some would argue, should be somewhat fluid in our public discourse.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that's one of the most important legacies of the founding fathers, is that they recognized that the world changes and they wanted to create a system that could adjust to those changes. And it's funny, you brought up Alexander Hamilton, and of course, you know, we have the, you know, the Federal Reserve, and still our economic system doesn't resemble anything that even he could have predicted, you know. But they did create these mechanisms that could adapt and change with the times.
You know, it's commonly held that civic virtue includes the responsibility of the citizen to place his or her interests above society. You mentioned the famous JFK inaugural snippet, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." But that belief was echoed originally before political parties. When Aristotle talked about civic virtue, he didn't have political parties in mind. Or when Montesquieu talked about it, he didn't have political parties in mind. So is that view of placing the needs of the country above our own in the world of parties possible today?
You know, that's a great question. That's certainly an advantage of political philosophers or philosophy in general or academia in general, that these institutions exist outside the system of partisan politics. And it's easy to get lofty and idealize, you know, what things like virtue look like. But when you get into the mud, when you begin to wrestle through political issues that are affecting our communities in the here and now, it gets messier. And I think it's important to be able to navigate between those two poles, between the, you know, the philosophical on one hand and the political on the other. But I also think it's important to remember that those two things don't have to oppose one another. Often we think of those things as opposition. You know, we have our idealized world on one hand, but then we have the practical world, the real world on the other. But if we take this notion of civic virtue seriously, this notion that it's all about, you know, cultivating the means by which we can engage our politics more ethically, the more we do that, the more we close the gap between the process and the ends, the more, I would argue, they come together, so there isn't that chasm between them.
And you sort of touched on this earlier, but we live in a world now where I go home and I turn on my cable news channel of choice or my blog of choice to reinforce what I already believe. I never factor in the possibility that there might be a gap in my thinking. While I hold the worst assumptions for you, since you happen to view exactly the opposite of what I believe, I have no hope that you can have any truth in what you say. So if I'm living in that world, are we not just slowly building a chasm that cannot be crossed if this notion of civic virtue or whatever we want to call it is to be achieved in a democratic republic.
Yeah, yeah, that's absolutely right. When we look at the ways in which mass media are utilized today, this kind of uses and gratifications means by which we turn to the news only to echo our own beliefs and values, we continue to put ourselves in these echo chambers. It's an enemy to civic virtue. But I think there is a way out. I am optimistic. I think as demoralizing as it is when we turn on the cable news, for example, I'm much more inspired when I begin a conversation with someone in person, including people with whom I really disagree, because those interpersonal conversations and debates too, they can be argumentative, but I think at the interpersonal level, they become much more productive. And so I would caution people not to be too dissuaded by what they see in the mass media, because that I don't think that's a genuine reflection of the polis. You know, people make a lot of money on dividing the nation, but when you get into the you know, real conversations on the ground level, you find that our beliefs and values are much more nuanced and much more generous than any of those cable news shows would have us believe.
To be fair, we mentioned Alexander Hamilton earlier. I mean, there were certainly Hamiltonian newspapers that sided with the belief of Alexander Hamilton, and there were also Jeffersonian newspapers. So this notion of having our beliefs reaffirmed is not a new one in American democracy. Is that fair?
That's absolutely right. You know, I'm not a historian, but historians love to point out these facts that when you know whatever we try to say about our contemporary landscape, oh, we've never been so divided, we've never seen this or that before, historians will always come back and say, actually, we have seen this before. This isn't really new.
And then I also wonder, are we condensing in the 21st century, from your perspective, sir, are we condensing political allegiance with civic virtue, thereby removing in responsibility of the citizen? So my party and civic virtue are synonymous. Is that also a challenge for us?
I think so. When your party is the party of the good and the opposing party is the party of evil, then you foreclose the possibility of deliberation. It is devoid of civic virtue. So in that sense, ironically, virtue signaling by party affiliation or otherwise is perhaps one of the biggest obstacles and enemies to civic virtue. We really have to get past that desire to signal our virtues, to swear our allegiance, whatever we want to call it, and engage or embrace the messiness of public life.
You know, I just, over the weekend, I was in conversation with a person who saw the world somewhat differently than I did, and they were basically suggesting on social media, you know, hang on to your hats, some new information's coming out and the election's going to be changed. And my response was, okay, this person was talking specifically about the Georgia presidential race. And I said, well, all right, do you believe that the Republican governor who in his own words, supported President Trump, and the Republican Secretary of State, who supported President Trump by his own admission, are involved in this massive cover-up? And their response was, well, you're a globalist, so you wouldn't understand. And so I guess what I'm saying, the point there is that it really didn't matter what I said at the point that I didn't fully agree with what she said. That was the end of the conversation. How do we get beyond that so that there's someone who may see the world different from me, or I can hear the validity of their truth? Because they're not just categorically wrong because they see the world differently from me.
Yeah, that's such a challenge, and it's been reinforced with our political leadership over the last 4 years, where any criticism is automatically reduced to a particular label. So these labels are so anathema to authentic communication and productive political discourse. So when I'm talking with someone with whom I disagree, I'll ask them, you know, let's put the labels aside. Don't look at me as a professor or as a member of a particular party or ideology, and I'll extend you the same courtesy. And let's just talk to each other as two citizens, two community members, two people interested in this particular issue. Because as soon as you label someone, then you reduce them and you reduce their idea, and it's no longer productive at that point. You're no longer communicating. You're just dismissing.
Once again, going backwards to go forwards, if you will, I mean, what you're saying, isn't that when Madison was concerned about factions in Federalist 10, wasn't that Madison's concern? This is even before political parties, that we would get into these little factions and we could only hear the echoes of our factions in order to move forward.
Yeah, to my knowledge, that's absolutely correct. Yeah, I would agree.
Given the historical shelf life of republics, we know that republics in and of themselves do not last long. I mean, we're doing quite well here in America for being around as long as we have. Certainly the founders were aware of the potential downside to a republic. And I wonder, as we're talking about civic virtue and appreciation for it or a lack thereof, are you concerned that we might be reaching an end to this democratic republic as we currently know? And if so, what will we be going forward? Or what might we be going forward?
Well, typically governments don't fall overnight, with obvious exceptions, such as the French Revolution, where there was a clear and sudden transfer of power. But outside that age of revolution, historically, history typically moves more slowly. So with regard to the shelf life of our republic, the question implies we're still living under the same republic founded in 1776. But in many ways, we are not. Of course, we maintain certain mechanisms and symbols that provide a cohesive narrative. But we have changed in many ways, for better or worse, in different respects. For me, the Supreme Court declaring that money is speech and corporations are persons articulated a fundamental transfer of power that shook our core principles. But the greater public hardly noticed it or understood its implications. If, however, the president came out and said wealthy people can now vote twice, there would be outrage. But both decisions essentially arrive at the same conclusion, but only one fits within that narrative. So perhaps the only constant in our republic is the name itself, and I don't see that changing. But to say that we're the same republic, I think, is misleading. You know, history for a long time was ruled by empires, and then there was a shift to the nation state. And now I think we're in an age of multilateral corporations that are really defining the landscape.
And I guess I'm wondering, if we're not overt about what civic virtue means for us in this particular moment, to follow up on what you said in your previous answer, civic virtue in 1776 was not civic virtue in 1863, wasn't civic virtue in 1920 or 1964. And if we're not overt about what that means in each generation, don't we risk putting it on the back burner and ultimately losing it?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I think our notion of what is virtuous is going to evolve in light of our context, in light of our needs, in light of our perceived purpose. And to some extent, you know, that's okay. But I do think it's important, as you suggest, to pause and reflect every so often and ask, okay, what does it mean to be a good citizen? What is my responsibility outside of any particular issue? What are my general responsibilities as a citizen? What does it mean to be a responsible citizen today? And that goes back to our conversation earlier about navigating between the political and the philosophical. I think it's healthy to step back and reflect every once in a while. Well, otherwise, it becomes a matter of means and ends, and the ends continue to justify the means. But with civic virtue, remember, it's an intrinsic good. So it's about the means itself. It's not about the ends. It's not about the external good. It has to be worthwhile in and of itself.
Professor Marinelli, you talked about the ends justifying the means. We're currently, in my view, in a paradigm where if my side does it, not only can I justify it, nuance it, and support it, but if you do the exact same thing, I can find all the flaws in it. I mean, for example, in my view, the rationale to not give Merrick Garland a hearing for the Supreme Court, that rationale was the same, well, almost the antithesis of sort of fast-tracking Judge Amy Coney Barrett, and the proponents of Judge Barrett were the opposition to Judge Garland, and it seemed to be no problem with either side. No one saw the hypocrisy in that. And that's the kind of thing I think that, in my view, undermines our civic virtue at some point.
I think that's a great point. And what's going on with the Supreme Court right now demonstrates how ends do not justify the means. So neither party is being genuine with what they're doing. It's about power politics. And each side wants to put their people on the Supreme Court. But that's going to come at a cost to the public trust. And it's going to be really difficult to reestablish that, because ultimately it cultivates a very cynical politics devoid of civic virtue.
Whose responsibility, is to restore that civic virtue? If we're electing people and those individuals on both sides are being rewarded for their lack of civic virtue, if I'm not, or we the people are not, calling them on it, and we only care about civic virtue when it's the other side in violation of it, in our view, then what is there any answer, or are we just adrift on this sort of the magnetized moral compass?
It's a great question. It's a challenging question. First, I don't know if it's a matter of restoring civic virtue per se, as if we ever had it figured out. So I would want to resist the temptation to idealize any particular time period. But I do think it's still a worthwhile endeavor. And I think it's all of our responsibilities. And we have to demand more from our political parties, from our representatives. But the good news is that it's highly within our grasp. Simply starting a conversation with someone, listening to their opinion, creating community with one another, all of these small acts are vital to the cultivation of civic virtue and vital to the democratic process.
Professor Kevin Marinelli, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Executive Director of the Program for Public Discourse. Thank you, sir, for joining us today on the Public Morality. Much appreciated.
You're welcome, and thank you. This has been a pleasure.
The Public Morality welcomes your comments. You can contact me at byron@publicmorality.org. That's Byron, B-Y-R-O-N, @publicmorality.org. You can follow me on Facebook as well as Twitter. The archive broadcast can be found on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you receive your podcasts. Once again, I want to thank Elvin Jenkins and Michael Burns at WJAB in Huntsville, Alabama, for allowing us to broadcast the Public Morality at their studios. The Public Morality is produced at WSNC on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. And in the words of Martin Luther King, we may have come on different ships, but we're in the same boat now. For all of us at the Public Morality, I'm Byron Williams.